This is Circulating Ideas. I'm Steve Thomas. My guest today is Emily Lloyd. She's the creator of the Shelf Check comic strip and is an associate librarian at Hennepin County Library. You can find her on Twitter at Posey Galore. Emily Lloyd, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
What most people at least initially know you from is for Shelf Check, your comic strip. First thing I wanted to ask you was there any comic strips when you were growing up that really got into your head?
Oh, well, that's a good question. Yeah, certainly that was in the days that there were just comics in the papers. And I really loved Zippy the Pinhead when it came out because it was a little bit more surreal and interesting. But, you know, as a kid, I read Garfield and things like that. And it interests me that Garfield is still as popular today as it was back then with kids. But no, I wouldn't say I was a huge comics reader necessarily as a kid.
Yeah, something about Garfield, I think, just clicks with kids because you read it as an adult and it's kind of like, this is kind of dumb, but kids just still just love it. So.
Yeah. I think it's one of those things that maybe folks that don't work in libraries would be surprised that Garfield is still so incredibly popular, but we can't keep it on the shelf at my library.
Yep. Yeah, you wouldn't know necessarily from newspapers because there aren't necessarily that many newspapers around anymore. So. Right. So why did you decide to start your comic strip? At the time you started it, the other webcomic about libraries, Unshelved, have been around for a few years. Was there something in Unshelved that you weren't seeing that you wanted to see out of a comic strip? Or what exactly got in your head of wanting to start it yourself?
You know, it wasn't necessarily that. It was the emergence of sites on the web where you could use their art and make your own comics. I first started working in public libraries in 1996. I was still an undergrad and had the idea for Shelf Check almost right away. Was interested in doing it for years. Tried to draw it myself. This was long before XKCD kind of let you knew that you could actually, you know, use stick figures and that would be okay. But frankly, my stick figures aren't as good as XKCD's. So I tried to draw it and failed and just kind of shelved the idea for years. And I remember when Unshelved, I think, first came out in 2001, and I was like, I wanted to be the one who did that. But finally in 2007, a site called toondoo.com came out, and you could go in and put in your own words and choose from clip art that they had pre-picked out. And that was the push, the ability, you know, the idea that I could actually do it now, you know, to some effectiveness without having to draw it. And one of the funny things about that, I guess, is that Toondoo had these pre-made characters you could choose. You know, they had several males and several females and things like that. And my main characters are Jan, a library paraprofessional who's queer, and Dave, her supervisor, who's the branch director. And both of them came from the male characters. When I see Jan, I think of her so much as just a queer woman, but she technically belongs to Toondoo's slate of male characters. Yeah.
So what about the comic strip format that you made you want to do that? I mean, what you said you had the idea for years beforehand. Why did you want to do that? Did you just have jokes in your head you wanted to get out about libraries, or what was it?
That's a good question. I had for years always been involved in some sort of comedy writing about what was, you know, whatever environment I was in. So when I was an undergraduate, I had a weekly humor column in the quote, quote, underground newspaper and things like that. And I don't know, when you work at a library, you see a lot of things that would probably make a good three panel strip, but it just seemed like, I don't know, something that would be kind of fun and interesting to do.
And did you get a good response right out of the gate, or did it take a while for it to catch on?
You know, strangely, I did get a pretty good response right out of the gate. I had not started a blog. Right now, the comic is mainly housed or accessed through shelfcheck.blogspot.com. I had not done that yet. I had put a few strips up on Toondoo, and I had tagged them, you know, libraries. And I believe it was the librarian in black who found them somehow and ran one on her site and said, you know, oh, I hope this person does some more comics. There's a new library comic strip in town. So right out of the gate, somebody noticed before I had even tried to promote it. And that was pretty neat.
That's librarians and their search strategies, I guess.
I guess. But someone had done, because I started it almost immediately after Toondoo announced that it existed. And so the fact that this new site, Toondoo, was around must have been on her radar. And maybe she just decided to search libraries and see, you know, if anyone had done anything.
Are you still happy with it today, the way you're still going? You don't do it quite as regularly as you did for a few years there, but you still come out with it. I don't know if you have an exact schedule anymore, or if it's just whenever you come up with an idea for
a I don't have a schedule, and I would like to do it more. When I first started, I guess in 2007, I was doing strips pretty much daily. And I was a heavy Google Reader user, and pretty much any story that came out about libraries, librarians, publishing, you know, ebooks, all that sort of stuff, I would use the strip as a way to kind of blog about it, respond to it, which is why at the top of the Shelf Check page, it says comic and or blog. It was very tied to news stories. I would link to the news story and have the comic strip that dealt with it in some way or another, just like you might see a news story and then the next morning talk about it with your colleagues. A library-related news story, and I slowed down. I think one of the reasons I slowed down was the demise of Google Reader, but that's only been about a year.
Can we blame the death of Google Reader for the last?
Yes, we can. We can blame the death of Google Reader. Although now I use Twitter a lot, but and for some of the same reasons. But it was, I didn't want to repeat myself, and I don't know, some conversations that I had really always striven to remark on in the strip earlier, I became kind of tired of those conversations recircling in library land, or resurfacing rather. Recently, for example, there was the article on Slate, What Does a Librarian Look Like? Or This Is What a Librarian Looks Like. And it was kind of this big kerfluffle on Twitter and things like that. And I thought to myself, in 2007, I would definitely have created a Shelf Check about this in some way or another. But these days, I just couldn't make my mind wrap around it, and I didn't want to. I felt like, oh, we're having this conversation again. And while I might be able to make some people grin about it, I was more kind of, I guess, a little bit tired of the conversation. Right. And didn't really want to contribute to it or comment on it, I guess.
Well, I've got a few. It's funny. I've got this whole list of, you know, of topics we're going to discuss. And we talked about it a little beforehand. I think everything comes out of what we've talked about so far. So I'm going to try to. I could go any direction at this point. So,
all right, go crazy.
So we'll start. We'll start with what about Jan is you? I mean, what is she like? Your voice exactly, or is she saying things? Do you skew things to make it more amusing? That not necessarily what you believe.
Jan is probably pretty close to what I believe. I think she might be a little bit more of an idealist than me. And it's interesting, there were moments, like I have two kids and I wanted to bring kids into, you know, the kids in her life into it, but they had to be her nieces because Jan has no partner, Jan doesn't date. And so I couldn't, you know, I couldn't bring those in a more realistic way.
You're not sure that the state would trust Jan with children and adoptions.
No, I think Jan's great. She's definitely, she loves the library. She's skeptical of some of the problems that, you know, beset libraries, some of the things we do to ourselves, in terms of bureaucracies and committees and things like that. And then Dave is a little bit more kind of a wide-eyed innocent, the sort of person that might apply a technology before he really has thought of a good reason to apply the technology, things like that. One thing I've been careful to do with Jan, I think, I'm sure people could go back and find examples where I didn't, but I am very careful to have Jan never be rude to patrons, and that's important to me. And that is something that I think I reflect in my own work. And a difference a little, I think a little bit between, say, Jan is the main character of Shelf Check and Dewey as the main character of Unshelved. Dewey is frequently rude to patrons, and I know a lot of people love it because they feel like, he gets to say the things I only wish I could say. And I don't know. Patrons are, and of course, I'm still actively working in libraries, but patrons for me are kind of the best part of my job. And I have worked in the past. I have a great staff of colleagues right now, but I've worked in the past with librarians who would be kind of rude to patrons, and it always made me feel bad and awkward. So that's kind of my higher, I don't know, my higher thing for Jan is that how do I make this funny without having that back and forth banter that is funny in Unshelved, but that I have this ideal that I want her to be a really good library paraprofessional. I want her to be someone that whose work I would admire, or that others would know that she's okay, I guess.
Sorry,
that was a ramble.
No. I actually like that about her too, because that's a difference. I don't like reading. There's a couple of books out there, of people of, I'm an anonymous librarian. I've written this book about how horrible my patrons are, and that's not
right.
That's not really my kind of thing either. So.
And even when people, a number of people will tweet about irritating patrons or something like that, and that's something I don't do. I might tweet about irritating policies or irritating DRM, but I don't think patrons are the most irritating part of most people's work days. I don't know. So who knows?
Well, so another thing about Jan is that she does not have her MLS. And I believe
she does not.
That's also true of you. Is that correct?
That is true.
So can you talk about working in the field without an MLS? And do you feel like that's held you back at all? Or do you feel like there's something you could have learned from getting that? Or?
I would love to have gotten or get my MLS if there was some way to get a full scholarship. I have one kid in college right now and another who is college bound in a couple of years. And the money aspect always just really frightened me. My sister has a law degree and so I had to take out loans for that. But in a law degree, you can pay the loans off in about 3 years of working in a high powered law firm. And I was always afraid to take on the debt. The study does not intimidate me. I would eat it up. I love reading stuff about libraries, academic texts, back and forth debates, things like that. I seek a lot out on my own. I'm pretty motivated self-learner that way. And a lot of the things that I've wanted to learn, I feel like I've been able to just probably by the luck of being alive in the time of webs and people posting slides online and people having conversations on Twitter and things like that. You can really stay up on a lot of things if you're interested in it through other means than sort of the traditional academic track. Like, for example, PLA was last week. I didn't get to go to PLA. And I went out to the PLA website and, looked at all the sessions and downloaded the materials that were provided. If it was a session that could, potentially have some relationship to the work I actually do, followed the hashtag on Twitter and felt like I got a lot out of the conference. So I do work very hard to try to educate myself and learn from others. And I've been really lucky. I've worked in two large suburban public systems. I worked for Fairfax County Public Library for 7 years, just outside the DC area, and currently work for Hennepin County Library. And I've been permitted to do in those systems, lots and lots of things. Most of the things I could want to do. I staff the desk and I enjoy that very much. And I would not want to work in libraries without being in contact with patrons. That is, to me, the best part of my job. So whether that's, on the front lines of the desk or, in a digital branch, doing social media for the library. Paraprofessionals always get to do that. Sometimes librarians don't. Sometimes they end up on a lot of teams and they're doing, different work in the back of the library and they don't get as much desk time. We're kind of counted on to hold down the desk, and I'm cool with that. I like that. But I've also been able to serve on system-wide teams, do story time, teach classes to seniors, do prison outreach, do all sorts of things, And I've been lucky that I've been in systems where that's the case. I know in some systems, maybe the line is more rigid, but I've been able to do those things. The downside of not having my MLS is that sometimes I can't apply for positions that I do think I'd be well suited to, and that I have the experience to be in, but the MLS requirement is right there at the front. That's, I'd say, the main difficulty, really, is that there are some positions I can't apply for. But it's hard to rationalize in my mind going back to school, taking out all those loans just in order to have the chance to apply for, a couple positions. One thing that's interesting, and that kind of bothers me about the MLS and libraries, really, is libraries have, traditionally from the start, embraced the idea that that people should be able to self-educate, that we're here so that people can come in, and if they don't have money, they can learn things. And I don't know, requiring an MLS sometimes feels counter to that. I would rather someone say, "What have you done? Show me what you've done," as opposed to "Show me your degree." But something interesting right now, my library system has an opening for a lead web developer, which is a huge position. It starts at $20,000 more than librarian jobs start at, and it doesn't even require a bachelor's or an associate. Basically, they're just saying, "We want to see what you've done. We want to hear about your experience. Show us your portfolio." Huh. And I would love that for that to be the case for more library jobs.
Yeah, it seems like, there are jobs where you'd want to have the MLS, but there are certainly jobs where it's not that the MLS could give you that education, but as you're pointing out, as you're living, you can get that that experience on the job as well. So,
Yeah, absolutely. And I have, about 20 years of experience at this point, and I've done a lot of stuff. I think sometimes, though, these days when jobs are so competitive, the MLS is also used as a way to, limit the number of folks who can apply in a positive way. I completely understand applying that filter because you just get bombarded with applications and you can say, okay, this person went to library school. But part of me wonders what that means to a hiring manager. What does it automatically say about a candidate that they went to library school? And I don't know if you have an opinion on that or not. I'd assume it means that they're committed to the profession to some extent, and that they did some academic work and got through. But I guess I'm not sure of the, intrinsic value of it.
I think the degree itself, I think, needs a lot. Part of the problem is that we're so infused with technology now with a lot of stuff that's changing so quickly that it's hard for the degree, I think, to change quickly because higher education degrees take a long time to process and change the curricula and all that kind of stuff. So I think we're a little behind. I mean, it sounds like ALA now is trying to work on that to bring the standards up to date, but.
Right. And start requiring things like coding and things like that, which I would be.
Right.
Coding, honestly, I would be thrilled to go to school for because that's something that, I've tried to teach myself on, but I would definitely do better in a situation where I was in a classroom and able to talk to other people and a teacher about something like that. It doesn't necessarily come naturally to me.
And I think a lot of times, I think librarians are just, because we're feeling this from the outside of people attacking libraries and taking funding away, all this stuff, that we're sort of clutching to our degrees and not really looking at how we should be using them. And so it's a sort of a job that currently requires a degree that we don't want to give that up and say, that person without a degree can have it, because that means
absolutely, absolutely. We don't want everyone. We don't want everyone to think we're paraprofessionals. We want people to know that. Well, I'm serious. We want people to know that. We do have specified knowledge. And I think one of the questions that often gets asked of librarians, just at a party when someone says, "What do you do?" "I'm a librarian." "Did you have to go to school for that?" Kind of an assumption that you didn't. And so absolutely, I can imagine that being the case. You want to sort of raise awareness that, this is a skilled profession and we can do a lot of things that Google can't. So yes.
And I didn't spend 2 years getting a degree just to learn the Dewey Decimal System either. So.
Right.
There's more to it than that. So.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. But that's a public perception problem, which is something I think we could work on separately.
Which also ties in, I think, to the reaction to all those "What does a librarian look like?" articles. I mean, we're very much about perception, I think, as to our to our detriment, I think. So
I think so. I think to our detriment, yes. I think rather than talking about it, we should be, I mean, I don't know who it is. I think it might be, is it PC Sweeney who does, and I just know him by his, I don't know what he goes by in person. I know him by his Twitter handle, who offered a prize to folks who would, you know, write articles about the profession for non-library, you know, venues, that he had, I think it was him. He had a yearly prize, like, you know, write about what we do, but get it in front of other eyes, you know, let's get it outside the echo chamber and raise awareness of what libraries do, which I think is fantastic, which I think we definitely need to do. Social media is one way we can do that well, I think.
Yeah. And that's one thing about the, I keep, you know, the Slate article that was the more recent as we're recording this article and that kind of thing.
Right.
You know, I don't even have a problem particularly with that one. It's just sort of the whole thing. It's like, I'm just tired of the whole conversation.
It gets tired. It's like every month someone who doesn't, you know, frequent libraries is like, oh, you know, I didn't get shushed and librarians have tattoos. And I mean, this has been going on for, you know, as long as the web's been around, at least. And yeah, I feel like we need to not just pay that no mind, like keep going on and that those getting bogged down in those conversations isn't particularly useful.
Yeah, yeah, it's the same thing. When I was growing up, I read a lot of comic books and stuff, and so then, but that was sort of the time when that first Batman movie came out, the Tim Burton one, that everybody started writing articles about, you know, wham bam, kids are comics aren't for kids anymore, and it's like, well,
right, exactly, very similar. Yes,
people who are already reading them already knew that,
have known that for decades. Yes,
and still now, yes. I mean, that's still the way they write articles, and so I guess librarianship will always be written about like that.
it might be. It definitely is.
At least people are interested in us.
Right. That's true. It's funny. The same week that the Slate article came out, I saw an article online. I can't remember the venue, but it was someone was taking portraits of bus drivers in England. And it was, you know, I think it must have been in Fast Company. And it was like, you know, heartwarming portraits of bus drivers. And it was interesting to see the difference between those two things. My grandfather was a bus driver. My kid's dad is a bus driver. And I wondered if that had been applied to the library, you know, heartwarming portraits of librarians, we probably would have gone, yeah, you know, heartwarming. And I felt that way about the bus drivers because I know a lot of bus drivers, you know, it's like, is there some idea that bus drivers wouldn't be kind people or, but it's interesting. Librarians often end up in those articles about public perception. It was just funny that those two came out the same week and if no one was talking about the bus drivers. Nobody was talking about the bus drivers.
You wonder if there's like this blogosphere of bus drivers that they were all complaining the same way we complained about.
That's true. It's possible. It could be that I don't follow enough bus drivers on Twitter. Yes, this is true. Yes.
Well, and I think in the same, that's a good example because in the same way of librarianship that we maybe are the stereotyped as the, you know, the horrible thing that happens to you and it's a wonderful life that you're stuck as a librarian for your...
Yes, so it's hilarious. Oh, if you didn't exist, your wife would have been a spinster librarian. Right. Oh my gosh.
Bus drivers are probably Ralph Cramden to most people's heads of just, you know...
Right.
I don't know.
Right.
Anyway.
Yes. But I want to go back and address something that you asked earlier that I didn't touch on, which was...
Sure.
You know, do I think there would be anything of value in the MLS for me? Absolutely. I don't want to say that I think that this is not a worthwhile thing to go through. I follow quite a few librarians on Twitter and in other, you know, other online venues. And one of the things I've asked, you know, for honest opinion of is, do you think if I went back and got an MLS, do you think it would help me in my current work? It would help me in what I'm doing? Would it make me better at my job? And I'll be 1,000% honest. All I've ever heard is no. I've never heard someone say, yes, you will be much better at your job. And that's what's important to me. I am not looking to, you know, go up to the system, be a branch manager and go that route. Of course, I'd have to get an MLS if I wanted to do that. But in terms of my daily work on the ground with patrons or working on, you know, system-wide teams, if it's not going to make me better at my job, that's what I'm interested now at this point is how to be the best library paraprofessional that I can be. And that's what's important to me.
Just like Jan.
Yes.
So another thing we wanted to talk about, and this was the topic that, it's funny that beforehand we kind of exchanged ideas about what we wanted to talk about, and it was everything mm-hmm. you sent me was exactly what I was going to ask you about anyway. So it was nice that we were kind of in the same wavelength. And one of the things is it's very obvious in your work on Twitter and on Shelf Check that, like you said, Jan is a lesbian, and you mentioned that as something that you wanted to talk about. The phrasing you gave me was very interesting that I wanted to bring it up, but you said talking about being visibly GLBTQ friendly at work. And so, and the visibly word is what struck me. And I wanted you to elaborate on that, because I mean, I think most of us probably think, oh, well, I'm friendly, you know, but I think visibly, I think it can be a key part of that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think I might've brought it up because I was recently having a conversation with a young librarian who is a lesbian, and when she'll say certain things that kind of, like, she'll say, I'm going out to visit my girlfriend, and her colleagues or her patrons, you know, they just think she's saying, you know, girlfriend, like your friend, it's a girlfriend's night, and things like that. And she's like, how visible, you know, because people will just kind of ride over it because, you know, we are a smaller subset of the population, and they're not going to default to thinking that that's what you're saying. And I shared a blog post I wrote. It's on Shelf Check. It's called Being Visibly Queer Friendly. Please consider it. And you can find it on the right hand. I had the prose post kind of pulled out. You can find it on the right hand side of the blog.
I'll link to it from the show notes here too. So.
Oh, okay, great. So a few years ago, I think it was 26. It was when the It Gets Better campaign first came out. And the reason I think that the It Gets Better campaign first came out, the reason, the motivation behind starting it, was that there had been this rash of suicides of queer teens, six that we heard about, I think six, in the space of a few months. And it had me thinking about being visibly friendly at work. So what I do is I made myself up a button. It's just a rainbow button, and it says, be proud at your library. And that's what I do to be visibly queer friendly. Of course, if a patron, you know, if it comes up in conversation, you know, oh, your husband must blah, blah, blah. And I'll just say, well, I have a partner, but, you know, and I'll always out about it that way. But people coming into the life, a lot of people, the library visits are part of the journey of a lot of LGBTQ people. It's sort of where, you know, they're going someplace, they're learning about themselves. Maybe not as much today as it was 20 years ago, but still a bit. And folks might not want to ask for things. And the catalog often doesn't make things very easy to find. The Library of Congress cataloging is not the queer friendliest. It really, really isn't. And another thing that I've got there on the blog is a slide deck from a training I did called Serving Our GLBTQ Patrons that I presented to library staff and then also ended up presenting to county staff, kind of showing places in which the catalog was offensive and things like that. But also going back to remembering how very, very much it meant to me as a teenager to see a LGBTQ friendly thing anywhere. I had a professor, and this is part of the post, but I had a professor who wore a button that just said that he supported LGBTQ rights. They were giving them out my freshman year of college for, you know, sort of an awareness week. And I got a button for myself. They were free. And I put it on in my dorm room. And then I walked to the bathroom, and I was in there alone. And then another person came in, and I ripped the button off because I just was not ready even to be out about supporting LGBTQ rights. And this was 91. But seeing that my professor had that button meant a lot to me and made me feel safer. And I think that's still necessary. I think even though we're in a place where we're seeing, you know, queer teens on Glee and gay marriage passing in a lot of places, right when those sorts of rights start to happen, GLBTQ folks, sorry, LGBTQ, I say it a couple different ways. It's okay. They're in the news every day. So you're a kid, you wake up, and there are people arguing on TV about whether you should be allowed to get married, or whether you should be allowed to, you know, run a scout troop or whatever. So there are positives, but you're also just seeing a lot of these things that are calling into question sort of your right to, I don't know, exist the same way as a non-LGBTQ person. And I think it's no small thing to see visible signs of friendliness. Just knowing that a person is going to be okay if you have a question like that. I do have a lot of folks, adults and teenagers, comment on the button. They'll just say, they'll come up and they'll ask me a reference question and they'll just be like, you know, by the way, I like your button, and maybe kind of blush or something. And it's a button, that one, I have several colleagues that wear it. You know, it doesn't say I'm queer. It just says, be proud of your library, you know? And so I have a number of straight colleagues who wear it too. Yeah.
Well, that's kind of the key, is everybody being that way, not just saying, oh, well, I'm gay, so I agree with this. And so it's like, well,
of course, right.
Of course, right. If you are, you agree with it. I mean, the key to overall acceptance.
Right. But a way to be, and it's, I'm not calling on everyone to do it.
Yes.
Right. But I guess I'm just saying that if you do support it, it's some folks, the visual can help a lot of folks who might not say something otherwise, who might not ask. You can really help. And again, going back to, I mean, it was born out of all those teen suicides. And if they had looked anywhere and seen something friendly anywhere, you know, in their immediate surroundings, obviously you can see friendly things, you know, online or elsewhere. But if they knew that, I don't know, the librarian at their public library thought that they were okay, maybe that would have helped. I don't know.
Well, and I think it's important. I mean, this issue, but lots of others, that the library be seen as a safe place for anything. Basically, I mean, for ideas, for the way people live, for your community. I mean, for everybody in the community, this is a safe place for you to come and learn about whatever you want and feel like you can do whatever you want.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yes, I think one of the most important things we can do at the information desk is be approachable and friendly, and never be like, ugh, someone's asking me a question, eye roll. But always be patient with someone, because it's no small thing to come up and ask a question. It isn't. I know, I'll say honestly, when I was a kid, even a college kid, I never asked a librarian a question. I think in some way in my head, it was like admitting failure that I couldn't find something by myself, but it never would have occurred to me. And for some people, especially, say, for example, if English is not their first language, you know, getting the courage to go up and ask a question and knowing that the person there will be receptive and friendly and patient versus not is really important, really important.
Exactly. I know creative people hate when you say, where do you get all your ideas from? But, you know, where do you get, how do you, so it's more, how do you refine your ideas, and how do you, are there people that you especially follow that you get special energy from, or that you like to collaborate with? And do you have anything?
Right.
Oh, I'll ask that later. So go ahead.
Sure. Where I get my ideas from, it depends on the project. With Shelf Check, I think people think, oh, you work in a public library, you just get those ideas from where you work. And the fact of the matter is, if I was writing about my library, the only people that would find it even remotely funny would be my coworkers. So for stuff like Shelf Check, again, when Google Reader was around, or seeing what issues are, you know, raising eyebrows and things like that, it's I really try to, you know, or LIS News, I guess I call it List News in my head. Those are the things that I'm always sort of casting around looking for ideas for, and obviously have not been doing as good a job of lately. For something like, I've done a lot of work on, you know, how libraries can have an effective Twitter presence. And for something like that, I'm pretty good at looking what folks are doing on a platform and figuring out what they're not doing and what we could maybe try. And so a lot of times ideas are coming just from looking at something and wondering how we could make it better. Ideas are a strength of mine. We recently took the Strengths Finder. I don't know if you're familiar with that test, but Strengths Finder at work, mm-hmm. Where you find out what your top five strengths are, and you slowly realize that those five strengths could also be what your top five curses are. And one of my strengths was ideation, which is just coming up with ideas. And the important thing in a library setting is to learn how to make those ideas friendly and interesting to others, especially folks that are able to say, hey, yeah, let's take a chance on this. Let's try this. And so that's something I'm always trying to improve at. You can have tons of ideas, but if the only person they excite is you, or the only person they seem feasible to is you, you know, that's not going to, you know, in any way make an impact in your system.
Do you feel like you also need to know how to be able to sell those ideas to your supervisor?
Yes. Yes. I took a MOOC, I don't know, about a year ago called Leading Strategic Innovation in Organizations. It was fantastic. If it's ever offered again, I highly recommend it. It was by a professor out of Vanderbilt called David Owens, and his book is called Creative People Must Be Stopped. And he was basically appealing to folks who, you know, do have ideas, and, you know, your boss asks you for ideas and you come with a bunch of ideas and they just crush all your ideas. Here's why. And it's very practical reasons. You need to be able to, it is on you. If you have a great idea and you want to go somewhere with it, it's not your supervisor's responsibility to, you know, to say, yes, absolutely. It's your responsibility to figure out a way to make it feasible to others, just to do the legwork of saying, here's what we would need to do. And to look at the possible objections and try to do that work. A lot of ideas people, I think, are like, these people are idiots. They never take my ideas, and we could be doing so much awesome stuff. And, you know, it's very important not to become that person that you're going to blame others for being too backward to listen to your fabulous ideas. I think I've strayed a little bit off the topic now, but yes, I guess, looking around at things and synthesizing things is pretty much where I get my ideas from. Refining them, it's something you need to put them into practice in whatever way you can and see what doesn't work.
Maybe you can elaborate on that with a specific example of why did you come to the library display that you recently posted
yes.
about. Can you talk about what that display was and the response you've gotten about it?
Yes. I came up with a really simple display idea for our library. And basically it was just asking patrons, why did you come to the library today? And it was a, you know, large, you know, a bulletin board covered with a piece of paper, and people could write what they came for. And they shared a lot of the images on Twitter, and it kind of took off, and, Library Aware shared it on Facebook and said, oh, this is a good idea. So it kind of took off a lot. And it really came out of a couple things there. Number one, a lot of times libraries are asking during National Library Week, you know, what do you love about your library? And that sort of question, you know, it really requires someone to sit down and think, and it has to, and you're only going to get respondents who, you know, love the library for one, or, you know, love the library enough to realize that this is a campaign to get comments and participate. And the reason I like a very simple question, like, why did you come to the library today, better, is because it's sort of a boom. That's why I came. You know, I don't have to love the library to say why I actually came here to make use of your services today. And so I think you get a lot more participants in something like that. And it starts to raise awareness of all the different things the library has to offer, all the different sorts of folks who use it. And that's what made it effective. I mean, we got answers, everything from, you know, I came here to work on my sermon, or to help, to learn how to help mamas give birth. So these really specific things. And, you know, we got a lot of, well, cause I love books. And then we got some that were, you know, no new movies were playing. And so I figured I would just come, and that's okay. That's okay. We want to know, you know, what's bringing you in here. And so it was really neat just seeing the variety of reasons people came in. Some were very practical. You know, you could tell they probably didn't come to the library often. It was like, I needed your scanner, you know, just for that one thing. But it was interesting to see the variety of reasons. And I think it was a lot more, it was, easier to participate in than something like, why do you love your library? And I think it ended up being more more meaningful and really kind of in some ways a better celebration of why people come to the library than just saying why they love it. It's just, well, really, why did you come? So
did you have any responses that surprised you?
Let's see here. I wouldn't say that they surprised me necessarily, although they might have stuck out that I didn't know. Like, for example, I didn't know that there was someone who came to the library to write sermons, or someone said, you know, to finish a poem or things like that. There was nothing that surprised me too much, but finding out those more specific reasons, like, hey, someone comes to write sermons in the library. I didn't know that. Those were the kind of really neat ones.
Okay. Another creative project you've got, not necessarily in your library, but in the world of librarianship, is the card game, Cards Against Librarianship. Can you, first of all, for people who may not know, explain what Cards Against Humanity is, and then why you wanted to do your own spin on it?
Yeah. Cards Against Humanity is a card game that has been on the internet for a while, but I think really took off this holiday season. You can download it for free, just Google Cards Against Humanity, or you can pay $25, I think, for an actual nice physical deck. And it's very similar if you've ever played Apples to Apples. It's the same concept. It's basically one person gets a question card, maybe a fill-in-the-blank card, and all the other participants in the game put down an answer or something that would fill in that blank. And the person running the round that time would basically just judge which one they thought was the most amusing or fitting or whatever. so kind of like a Mad Libs game. And Cards Against Humanity is very, it's the sort of thing that's like, oh, that's so wrong. It's got, you know, a lot of, I don't know how you would call it humor. It's provocative.
It's blue.
It's blue. It's provocative. It's, oh, that's so wrong. But it's also hilarious. And I had gotten that my partner had gotten that for me this holiday season. We were playing it with our 16-year-old and our 19-year-old, which was pretty fun. I don't know. And it just kind of occurred to me, wow, it would be so fun to do a Cards Against Librarianship. And, you know, and so I started working on it, and I threw the idea out on ALA Think Tank and found that some other folks had also been thinking of doing something like that. And midwinter was coming up in a few weeks. And so I just set myself the deadline of, hey, let's just actually, you know, let's just crank this out so that people can play it at midwinter. And that's why I made it. And I think it also, you know, as you mentioned, I have been really flagging, having long periods of not making any shelf checks. And this was a way of, you know, kind of channeling library related humor, in a different direction. You know, a way to be funny about libraries that wasn't shelf check. And so that kind of, it got me excited.
Would you ever want to sell decks yourself, or is that too much work?
No, I would not want to sell decks, but I do want to put out, and I might do it on Think Tank or, hey, through this podcast. What I would love is, to make the cards nicer. I just used very crude, you know, images and things like that. They're very, very simple. Someone had asked me, well, have you thought about making this a real actual, like, you know, nice looking card game? And there's a site called Drive Through Cards where you can do that. You can upload your own images and we'll put them on playing cards, and, you know, the things will last. It's not like putting something out on cardstock that's going to be wrinkled. And, what I would love to do is find somebody who would be willing to work on that with me. You need to know InDesign or is it Scribus, something else like that. So I've looked at the opportunity, the possibility of doing it myself, and I've determined it's really kind of over my head unless I had a lot of time. It is. I mean, you know, unless I had a lot of time to devote to sit down and learning about it, it's over my head. So I do want to put out at some point a call for, you know, does anyone like the idea of this so darn much that they'd be willing to, you know, put it together and make these cards look nice? And then what we would do was set it at the base price. We wouldn't make any money off it. We would just set it at the lowest price that Drive Through Cards allows, which is what I do on things like that. Be Proud at Your Library pin on Zazzle. You know, it's like, I'm not making any money off it. If you want to get it, it's at the lowest price possible, because it doesn't make sense to me to
right.
I don't know. I am a big proponent of the sharing economy and give away your ideas and give away this, that, and the other. I like that. I think, you know, it makes sense to me.
I guess in this case too, if you start making money on it, you might hear from some attorneys from Cards Against Humanity.
Yes, that is possible. The Cards Against Humanity is Creative Commons licensed.
Right.
And there have been any number of variations on it that have come out. I think there's a Doctor Who version, and there was like a House of Cards version. And I really think someone should do Cards Against Humanities, you know, someone who works in higher ed. So I think they're probably pretty cool about that. But yeah, you never know. If you were charging for it, absolutely, they could be like, ugh. But yeah.
Yeah, they're actually a pretty funny company. I don't know if you heard that on Black Friday, they actually charge more for the card deck.
Instead of
having a sale, they charge $30 instead of $25 for just for that one day.
Right, right. Yes. Oh, that's hilarious. No, I didn't know that.
Do you plan to keep you doing Shelf Check on and off?
I would love to. I need to find a way to do it where I think it's still funny. I can go back and look at ones from, you know, that are about technology or makerspaces or whatever it is, you know, from 2010. And here it's 4 years later, and those issues are still kind of the same issues. And I guess I just want some new issues to talk about rather than feeling like I'm rehashing the same stuff. So it's all about just finding new angles, new ways to make it interesting to me and to anyone else who might read it.
Well, I look forward to more. So.
Thank you.
So you said earlier that Jan is very optimistic about the profession. Are you as optimistic as Jan is?
Oh, I should take that back. I don't know that Jan's optimistic about the profession. I don't know. I think she's positive about patrons. But I don't know that she's necessarily optimistic about the profession. And I don't know how I feel about it either. I think, you know, may you live in interesting times, the curse. I think that's what's happening to libraries right now. I know there is a huge, huge need for our services, and that will only grow. I think we definitely have a marketing and PR problem. And I think we'll be around, but I don't know. I mean, I have seen some libraries are going towards not requiring the MLS and things like that. So I don't know if everything's going to take the same form. I'm not sure. And definitely I've had the feeling I do baby story time at work, or I have done it. You know, will the babies in this baby story time bring their babies to baby story time at the library? And unfortunately, my gut feeling there is no. So I want to think about why that is and how we could change that.
Well, I think a lot of the ideas that you've got are good ways of, because we need to make the library something that people want to come to. And I think a lot of the creative ideas that you've had are good for that. So
thank you.
So Emily, where can people go to find out more about you online if they want to read your writings and your comic?
Sure. The comic strip Shelf Check is at shelfcheck.blogspot.com. A lot of my other library related work, a lot on apps and early literacy, and then a lot on sort of this, I don't know, Twitter kind of method on Twitter that I came up with for libraries called Follow Your Patrons. Those are at slideshare.net/ELLOYD74. So slideshare.net/Eloyd74. And including that, serving our GLBTQ patrons, and then also tips on Twitter and on early literacy apps and stuff like that. I am Posy Galore on Twitter, so at Posy Galore. And those are basically my haunts.
Okay, and before we go, real quick, explain your Twitter name.
Oh, yes. So my background, it's funny how I met my partner and things like that, is for many, many years, I wrote poetry. And that's something I'd still also like to get back into. I have a, you know, silly chapbook floating out there somewhere. And so Posy Galore, of course, is just a pun on Pussy Galore from the Bond films. So, yeah. it was the name of my first blog, which is still out there existing in a dormant state. And so I just took it from that blog name and made it my Twitter handle.
Somewhere floating out in the internet.
Yeah. No, it's, yeah, not much is going on there right now, but it's out there.
All right. Well, Emily, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Yeah. Thanks for having me, Steve. It was really fun.
All right. Bye-bye.
Okay. Take care.
If you'd like to learn more about the podcast, you can visit circulatingideas.com, or you can follow the show on Twitter at @circideas or on Tumblr at circulatingideas.tumblr.com. You can also like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/circulatingideas. And if you have comments, questions, or suggestions for future interviews, you can contact the show at circulatingideas.mail@gmail.com. Music is by Pamela Klicka. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll join me again next time. So I wanted to talk about that, but yeah, I was like, that'll be a long discussion, so I better not bring up another
one. No problem. That's great. Yeah, now if anyone wants to listen to me talk for almost an hour, that's, you know, that's as much as I could ever want to ask, so...